Hi, I'm Scott Cooper, and this is the Tales from the Trail podcast by Match Play. In this episode, Justin Chesham, head men's soccer coach at Christopher Newport University, and I welcome Angela Hughes Mangano. Angela is the general manager of Angel City FC of the NWSL. As a player, Angela was a four-year All-ACC player at the University of Virginia and remains the career leader in goals, game-winning goals, and total points. As a member of the U.S. Women's National Team, she won two Olympic gold medals and finished third in two World Cups. She played professionally in the W League, WUSA, and WPS. She has served in various roles as an ambassador and leader in sports. Angela is a legend of U.S. soccer, and it is an honor and privilege for us to have her as a guest. Thank you, Nataki Cornell, for making this happen.
So Angela, we were talking a little beforehand. I actually played against your brother. I remember one time for sure. I feel like it was a couple more times, but I played Division III soccer here at CNU, and your brother was at William & Mary at the same time. And we would play. I believe I played against him. I know I played against William & Mary twice. I can't remember if it was either the same class as me or not, but I still remember the one time because it was Phil, your brother, and that team had loaded up. They were really good, and they returned everybody. And we were rebuilding a little bit that year. And long story short, I haven't played that much defense in my entire life. I was an outside back in that game. And that was a long day. Your brother was an incredible player. I just looked him up. He's now a Hall of Famer at William & Mary. And he was awesome. I wish I was watching the game, not trying to mark him. There were a few other players. Charlie Garcia was on that team too. So yeah, what a great team, great match for them. You know, they played really well. They were fun to watch that game. I didn't get much of the ball, so definitely. You can ask him if he remembers me. I'm like, I think I saw him picking up the ball in the net a couple of times. You know, that might be his only memory. So it was fun. So you're from Virginia Beach?
I am. I'm from Virginia Beach. Yeah, part of being the older sibling. I loved watching my brother play. Did not get to see him as much as he probably saw me play. Maybe to his chagrin. But born and raised Virginia Beach, grew up there, and really wasn't until went to college at University of Virginia, and wasn't until after college that I actually moved out of state.
What was what's the age gap?
4 years.
4 years. I'm trying to think. So that would have been late 90s. Where'd you go to high school?
Is it Norfolk Academy?
Where would you have gone if you went to public school?
We were probably a really good, hefty throw. We were in Great Neck. Oh, so okay. Right across from Cox High School.
Cox, gotcha. Yeah, they're still power. They're still very good. Yeah. Boys and girls side. Were you a Beach FC girl?
Yeah. Now being out in Los Angeles area, there's a Beach FC out here, and so when I say I play for Beach, like, oh, I was like, nope, East Coast, different beach. But
yeah, when we go to the UCNL events, they say Beach FC California, Beach FC Virginia.
Oh, really? Okay, there you go.
You guys need to play, and whoever wins gets the name. You know, so
right? Yeah. I know, bragging rights.
Of course. So what is Phil doing now?
He's a lawyer now. He actually. Ooh. After William & Mary, he dabbled a little bit in the footballing arena and actually got drafted to play in MLS and played for in Hampton Roads before going overseas and doing some trials over there and wound up realizing that he didn't want to make a career out of it. So took some time off and went to law school, and then he's now labor and employment law. He's actually back in Virginia Beach area. Yeah. He was out in LA for a little bit with a firm here, and then moved back close to home.
Wow, that's great. Well, your family must be proud. You got two strong family members there doing well. That's awesome to hear.
Yeah, a lot of parent support and sacrifice over the years to really help us get and achieve some of the things that we wanted to in life. So always appreciative of it.
Absolutely.
How were your parents like? So we talk a lot about recruiting and how kids are these days, and I say these days, and I sound old when I say that, but how were your parents towards you and your brother? And obviously, you guys had some inherent talent to play the game, but you know, I'm sure that they treated you and you were brought up in a certain way that kind of, I don't know, optimized that or maximized that. And, you know, talk about how that was growing up with the way your parents were.
They had to figure it out. They didn't know what they were doing, really. You know, I think we were the first ones in my side of the family, one, to play the sport. I think, secondly, to actually do all the things that, you know, most parents just kind of do today with their children, if they're able, you know, with travel and club and things like that. And it's always fascinating to me to really be asked the question of and sought out for advice on how to raise a child as a sporting parent, and really with the hopes of making college and being able to participate in college sports, because, you know, especially for soccer, it's just changed so much. But when you look at collegiate sports, it's changed so much. Recruitment practices has changed so much. But I think the biggest thing for my parents, really, it was just that foundation of doing whatever was in their power to support us with what we wanted to do, challenge us in the areas. And I guess at the times that we really needed to be challenged, right? I think my mother, I always say I'm a psycho baby because my mother is a clinical psychologist. And so she really was teaching us sports psychology before we even knew what sports psychology was. Yeah. And I didn't believe it until I actually heard some of the same things she had told us for years, until it was coming from a sports psychologist. But I think, you know, those car rides home after games, after tournaments, and, you know, the player or the self-evaluations, right, of how you played. And it was never, you know, all positive. It was allowing the time and space for myself, for my brother, to take note of our own play, of, you know, and evaluate ourselves. And I think that helped to train different muscles and teach us different habits that were really positive. Because as we all know, you know, coaches, you know, the comments, the feedback, you know, that we get, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not helpful. And so our ability to really navigate what we could take and make ourselves better, and the things that we just kind of had to toss to the side and not pay attention to, I think those were the things that we started to, you know, become skilled on in those car rides home. It was a good performance. You know, my parents were like, great job. Like, this is great. How are you feeling? But I think being able to also have the opportunity to really critique our own selves was extremely helpful. And I think something my parents did really well.
How did your mom, how'd they breach that? You know, cause we try to advise families all the time. I've got little kids. We haven't had the car ride home yet. I got a 6 year old who's at camp today and he's still learning how to kick a ball. So we have a long way to go, but what would your parents ask? I mean, what's something that like I can use for myself here in a few years if I've got a good little soccer player?
I think it's like everything. It's relationships and knowing your child, right? For a coach, it's knowing your player. It's not just their abilities, right? And in terms of the sport, it's just knowing them as a person, what makes them tick, all of those things. I think that's where it's really rooted from. And that I think really helps to guide and navigate those types of questions and what they need in that moment. It might not be, we also had some quiet, silent car rides as well, right? Where there was no communication. And I think sometimes we just need space and to be peppered with, like, you know, evaluate. What do you think? Let's do some debrief here. Definitely the early stages, you know, and understanding that the number one reason that children leave sports is because they stop having fun. Just making sure that that's at the root of it as well. If they enjoyed the experience, and I think that is definitely more of the focus and how you frame questions and what the conversation may or may not look like with a younger aged player versus someone who's a little bit older. But I think for me, I can honestly look back at my career and say that I always played soccer because I enjoyed it. It doesn't mean it was always easy. It doesn't mean like I didn't have my challenges, right? But I always found joy in the sport. And the time that it started feeling like a job, that it actually was really when I started to plan my exit and retirement. So I think that's just vital to one, sustainability, to performance. But I think that needs to be there. And I think that's also something parents can do, is just keeping tabs on that, right? Is your child still enjoying this? Is it feeling like it's too much? Is it too much pressure? Is it too much of this?
Sure.
I started playing other sports, right? What can we do to help balance this out? So I think those are some of the things that, no matter what age and stage, parents can also, you know, really help to navigate for their child.
That sounds like your mom knew, okay, Angela's not in a good place right now. We're gonna buy a car ride home.
Yeah.
I'll wait till maybe we win a game, but she didn't play her best. That might be when I hit her with a few things.
I am a Cancer sign. I can be a little moody sometimes. So yeah.
I guess we're all Cancers then. Wow, that's wonderful stuff. And you know, maybe we'll get your mom on here so she can kind of go over. So
she would love that.
That's good advice. It really is.
We could probably just hit play and just let her roll.
Yeah. Reenact one of your actually, how do you handle posts now on the other side of things?
How do I handle just
like, you just had a game? I mean, yeah. Are you just like you were after a game as a player, or is it like, all right, well, I'm in a different uniform right now. I don't, you know, I'm not as worried about it. What is your post game mentality like now after wins and losses?
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting. Definitely having different responsibilities in the role that I am. I'd say being a player and being on the administrative side and business side of sport is completely different. And there are a lot of things that, you know, you as a player probably aren't aware of. You know, we'll call it behind the scenes, or just, you know, on the admin business side, which, you know, shouldn't really be a concern to the players, right? That's not their job. That's not their responsibility. But I think, you know, post-match, for me, I'm always huddled and circled up with my staff, my coaching staff, and, you know, just doing that post-match debrief right when it's fresh and coming off. And then a day later, it's going to be, you know, perhaps different things in the conversation, but it's back to the drawing board right away, especially if we've lost, see what types of things need to be tweaked, changed. And I think for my role specifically as general manager, it's like definitely more big picture. You know, our head coach is definitely more, you know, focused and game to game and week to week, and maybe, you know, a block, right? 3 to 4 games out. So we all have to come at it and approach it from the different lenses and put all the, like, really, it's like a chess game of the pieces together and strategically think about the moves that we might need to make and be very intentional about what that looks like in that strategy, whether that's game to game or transfer windows, right? Mm. And that's something that I'm largely responsible for as well. And we're in a place now, being in our third season, where it's not just the next transfer window, right? We have to evaluate, and we're fortunate that we are at the stage where we're looking two and a half, three windows out now, where we just weren't able to do that when we were first starting up as a club. So, you know, it's really trying to take everything together, all the feedback, all the thoughts that the coaches and our technical staff are talking about, and having that dialogue and conversation, and then figuring out what this next week is going to look like for them. And then for me, it's also looking at big picture a few months from now, looking at towards the next transfer window, and or, you know, how we're going to support our coaches, support our players moving forward.
Yeah. I remember when I first started coaching, and I won the Sun Cup. Is that what it's called? The Virginia Beach Sun Cup, I believe it's. We were at the Hampton Roads soccer complex.
Yeah.
And I had 10-year-old kids, and I still have the little medal. It was better. It was a better feeling than any personal accomplishment I ever had. So my question for you
That's
is:
awesome.
You've won a bunch as a player. You have a you know, long list of awards that I didn't even know they existed. That's how great they are. do you feel a bigger sense of accomplishment now that you're kind of like, oh, this is all my team. Like I put this together. I kind of put it, you know, is there a different feeling when you guys win? I mean, is it close to what I was talking about with my 10-year-old kids?
Yeah, I think it's incredible. I think, you know, as you get to the higher levels, it's more work. It's harder, right? There's no guarantees. And I think especially in this league, in the NWSL, it's extremely competitive. It's one of the most competitive leagues for women in the world. So, you know, last year there was this really cool animated board of all of the teams. And it was like the last game of the season before playoffs. And based on the real-time results of what was happening, teams were moving up, teams were moving down. And it was like, and we didn't know who was going to be in that, you know, top six for the playoffs. And that's how competitive this league is. And we're in another situation right now where even the last place team currently out of the 14 teams still has an opportunity to make playoffs. So, you know, you have to show up, you know, week to week. And so any win feels great. I think we have really big aspirations of what we really want to do on the pitch and in terms of being able to really build this legacy in the city of Los Angeles, in a very sport-specific town and a town of entertainment, because of what we know it can really do in terms of the impact in the community. And I think our organization is strongly rooted in the values of service and community. And we have a sponsorship model, which we give 10% back to our community with any type of sponsorship dollar that comes into the club. So we've got this great global brand as a football club, but the pressure and the privilege that we have is we want to be able to now match that in terms of our performances, in terms of winning championships. And not just to do it once, right? I think it's great to do it once, but we want to have that sustained success. And I think a lot of times, you know, when that's the approach and where you focus your attention and building the right culture and the foundation for a club at the very beginning, sometimes that might take a little bit more time to build into the championship team. But the hope and the thesis that I have is that we will be able to do that for a sustained period of time by doing it in, you know, this way.
You guys were in the news a little bit last week. I saw there was a kind of a big player came into play there with a substantial amount of investment. And so talk about, you know, the pressure, you know, of dealing with, you know, those eyeballs on you now and, you know, trying to get it right. And, you know, you have a celebrity laden list of owner in your ownership group and your board. And, you know, that has to be, you said you grouped the two words pressure and privilege together. And, you know, you've done great things in your life, so you've earned that pressure. So talk about how you handle that. And, you know, this is useful for anybody and how your example of handling pressure and how, you know, anybody who's just standing on the field waiting for the kickoff can handle a lot of the same in a lot of the same ways. So maybe just kind of walk through dealing with that and, that's my question, I guess.
Yeah, the core element I think that is really important is the people that you surround yourself with. Right? This is something that it's not just unique to our space. I think it's really a great solve in any space, in the industry, any person. And I say that because when you have good people that are around you who can relate, who are competent, who are aligned with the vision that you have, when you hit adversity and when you have challenges and when you are feeling that pressure, you know, you're able to share this experience together and help get yourself through. And I think, you know, when I stepped into this role as general manager for this club, it was looking at our staff and our people and making sure that we had the right people in the right positions who could be bought in to the vision of what we're trying to achieve here. And so that was kind of, you know, the high level and then how we work backwards from there. And I think also the pressure piece is very individualized as well and how you handle it, because, you know, what may work for me, Scott, may work something completely different for you, right? And I think it's having a level of self-awareness that, you know, you really tap into as well, whether it's, I know that you know, getting up and having my meditation and my workout in the morning, because I'm not going to get it in once I hit work. Like, I got to get that in for keeping myself level-headed and being able to maintain whatever's thrown my way, because, you know, sometimes I don't know what it's going to look like day to day, right? And that could be part of the excitement. I also think, you know, being an athlete has really helped to train, at least me personally, with how to handle that pressure. I think being able to understand that it's going to always be there. So it's not like you're trying to get rid of it, but how you embrace it, how you step into it, where you lean into, what are your ways of getting through it? You know, what are the habits that you have? But also knowing that it's not going to last forever. I think that's another thing too, just how you are able to have the right mindset. You know, that's why it's a pressure and a privilege, right? That's why we get to build this incredible club. Not that I have to, or that, you know, oh, I got to go in and do this. You know, I have to do this, right? It's the language we use and the mindset that we have that really help to shape how you deal and how you handle the pressure. And then what are the activities and the things that are your go-tos that you can really anchor in to get you through those pressure moments?
Yeah, it's such a good point about, you know, how being an athlete helps. I can't tell you how many times people call me asking for just regular businesses that, hey, mm-hmm. we're looking for college athletes. We're looking for kids about to graduate. Yeah. And it's because of that mindset. You can't turn it off. It just, right. I'm 41 and I should never play soccer again in my life. But if I'm out there kicking around, it kicks in and my mind is still 22, you know, you could do all this stuff and my legs are just laying on the ground behind me. So yeah, it never ends. It really is something else. Scott, do you have a follow-up on there or do you want to shift?
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask about her journey, but if you have a follow-up.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, you know, we had talked a little bit about how you're at Beach FC and, you know, went off to go into college. And it's interesting. We've had a lot of new guests the last, you know, few months where we haven't had this discussion, but specifically your recruiting process in 1996, what was that like and how does it compare to today? We can kind of discuss that a little bit, but what was that like? And, you know, you went to UVA and I remember I was in high school in the late 90s and it was, oh, you're going to UVA? Oh, okay. All right. You know, I was a high school kid in Virginia. So that was the place to go. That was our national team for college soccer. So, and if you don't mind, tell us how that went. Oh,
and try to sprinkle in a good story about Coach Swanson, if you can, because he's one of our favorite guests that we've had on here. So
wait, was he there?
No, I love Steve. Oh, right. No, but I happy to sprinkle in some Steve, as I call him, stories too.
Yeah.
Which I think is a testament to him more so than anything else. But yeah, I think for me, it was, again, a new territory, a new space. Like, my parents had never been involved in. They went to a D3 school, Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. They both participated in sports, but, you know, we're not recruited athletes or recruited student athletes. And I think it was definitely just a trial and see how this goes and try to navigate the best we could. And I think fortunately I was in a lot of environments where I was able to get seen, mm-hmm. you know, both with club. And I think, you know, even where things have changed so much with high school and club and, you know, the participation in both or not being able to do both. So I participated with Beach and was in, you know, the right places too, where we did have college scouts with some of those tournaments.
Sure.
My high school coach as well. You know, it's definitely different, right? Playing for a private school where there's really not a whole lot of opportunity to be scouted or seen for college sports. My high school coach, Kevin Sims, went to UVA, played soccer at UVA. And so he also came from a mindset and an experience of, you know, playing at a higher level in college as well. So he actually had us going and competing against schools outside of state and really being able to set us up to have some great visibility. And we were successful there as well. And then I think the other thing was just ODP and the Olympic Development Program was probably the primary way back then in which, you know, we were scouted for college. So, you know, I had my times with, you know, making the the state teams and the regional teams, and then, you know, being in those regional camps, which all the coaches were college coaches, right? So it was a great way for them to do their scouting, and then eventually making, you know, a paper list of a national team pool. And then back then it was just the U20 national team and the women's national team. Like, that was it, right? So all of those opportunities, environments, I think really helped. And you know, went through the normal, like, I don't even know if it's called normal now, but just, you know, getting the calls and getting the letters in the mail. I tapped into my college counselor at school, but I think that was something that, you know, they weren't really able to help navigate because they didn't really have, you know, students that were being recruited by colleges for sports. And so just kind of putting all those things together and ultimately being able to just, again, lean on my parents and ask for their support. I do remember there was a time which I'd already committed to Virginia, and I got a call from another college. I can't remember the college at this time. And, you know, they asked to set up a meeting and to potentially bring me in. And I was just, I had such a hard time just saying no. And basically actually saying, like, no, I've already committed for whatever reason. Obviously a lot of personal growth since then, but I hang up the phone and I tell my mom and dad what happened. And my mom's like, Angela, like,
yeah,
you gotta call them back. You can't right. do this, you know?
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So just being a, you know, young high school person, and just, you know, starting to understand some good life skills at that point too. But I think it was because it was overwhelming too, to an extent. Right? Yeah. It's probably the biggest decision that I had to make at that stage of my life. And so the pressure of, you know, choosing the right college for your career, for your life, for your future. I think I was probably feeling a lot of that. And I also wanted to go to a school that I could, you know, focus on soccer. There was no professional women's soccer league in our country at the time. It wasn't something that was really on my radar. It was more of to make the national team. So I think all of those things definitely played into the decision and into the process. But again, I go back to just being able to have, whether it's your parents or, you know, some caring adults, you know, to really help support, you know, an athlete, a student athlete through that process is really important.
It's funny. You mentioned not wanting to tell the coach, like, I'm already committed and stuff. And I actually, our women's counterpart here talks about that sometimes as well. And it's like, you can tell us, it's really okay. We're going to get turned down a lot this year. It's just the way it's the nature of the business. And, you know, you're not going to hurt our feelings. It would hurt me more if you showed up and I'm like, I think it went great. And then I call you and you're like, I've been committed for a few weeks. And so I didn't want to tell you no, you know?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Just tell us. You're not going to hurt our feelings. I mean, we wanted you to come
for the record here. She's right. Santa for the record for all you all listening.
That's right. 100%. Please don't tell me your introductory message from UVA was through the snail mail. Did that happen to you? Or did they kind of throw ODP like, oh, hey, nudge, nudge, that's a UVA coach and you got the chat?
I don't think it was, but I had an interesting recruitment even from UVA just because I was recruited by the then coach, Lauren Gregg, and her staff. And I believe it was, you know, an assistant coach reaching out or assistant coaches reaching out to me versus snail mail. But when I made my decision to verbally commit to UVA, it was after Lauren Gregg had stepped away from being the coach. So I actually committed when they had not hired the new coach.
Wow.
At that point.
Who'd you commit to?
April Heinrichs was who was appointed.
Kind of a...
So it worked out. Well, you know,
but she
a young...
wasn't there. When you committed, correct. Who did you... So
it was the assistant. It was the assistant coach at the time. Yeah.
Did they
They did not. Yeah. So the whole staff, coaching staff, pretty much went out with Lauren, and April brought in a new staff. You know, back then she was a young rising star on the coaching scene. And so, yeah, there was this gap of, you know, coaching staff, Lauren Gregg and her staff leaving, and April had not been hired yet. And I said, yes, in between that. And that just goes back to, I think, having clarity of my reasons of selection, right? Why did I want to go to this college over another college, or what was I really looking for? So I think that's really important. And I knew I wanted to go to a really good educational institution, as well as one that I felt like I could also make an impact with the soccer program, but had a certain level of success already, but I could help to elevate it, like with my attributes. So eventually, so it was not because of a specific coach that I chose this university, because even in that example, we know coaches can come and go. So I think that was for me a good early lesson in just understanding and just having that clarity going into university.
That's, to me, that's amazing, because you never, if I heard of someone right now committing to a school that had just lost a head coach for whatever reason and hadn't hired a new one yet, you never would have heard that story. So it sounds like you've had a bunch of different coaches and you're like, hey, it's the coach. I'm just going to go out there and do what I can. I mean, it's, to me, that's amazing. I've never heard of anybody doing that. I can't fathom that.
I mean, I just did tell you the story about how I was like, didn't have the courage to call, you know, the other coach. And I mean, a little naive at the point too, but sure, yeah, definitely don't hear that too often.
Well, you also mentioned ODP, and yeah, I mean, back then it was, I remember that, state tryouts, regional tryouts, it was all, everybody was there that was top players. You walked out there and you're like, okay, yeah, everybody's here. These guys are all good. Mm-hmm. And it's really, you know, there's still definitely great kids, especially at the younger ages, but it is not the animal it used to be by any stretch. And yeah, it's a little bit of a bummer. So after UVA, you went and you played, I believe it was at Boston, right? You were a Hampton Roads, was it Piranha? So I played around here.
So the funny story that Piranha's, Marcy Lohman, I mean, incredible. I think just a woman ahead of her time in terms of what she saw for women's soccer. I think my first time I actually went out and trained with that team, I was like 13 years old, playing against these like women. And so, you know, had familiarity with them. But when I was in my senior year, my fourth year at Virginia, was probably the time, because I graduated in 2000. So it was probably the time in which I started actually receiving letters for the WUSA draft. They're going to have this new professional league, and they're going to have a draft, and they're going to have a tryout. So that's when the thought of this new pro league really started to get on my radar, because it literally wasn't until my last year in college that happened, for the launch of the first pro league, WUSA, in 2001. So there was a time period in which I actually committed to take a job after I graduated from UVA. I actually was in Charlottesville, Virginia, and I talked to the hiring manager and my ultimate manager about this possibility of this new pro league coming out. And if there was a chance of it, I would be remiss and regret not being able to at least try out. So I had to have that conversation. I remember my dad was in the car with me, and I like waited. He's like, Angela, this is the reason why you met him. Like, had lunch with him, and like, you need to talk to him about this. So again, just extra urging from my parents, and just basically said, I would be thrilled to take this job, but also I just need to let you know that this is something that I would want to do. Like, is that okay? And so gave his blessing and said, if and when that comes up, you are more than welcome to go and try out. And so that's what I did. I worked for Ferguson Enterprises for 3 months, and you know, on Route 29, and then gave my notice in and went and tried out and got drafted to Boston. And the circling back to your earlier comments about Steve, I think he's been such a fixture at Virginia and has done just an incredible job of keeping, you know, alums included in the school and up to speed. And obviously he's had his time in currently with the US team and being an assistant coach with the national team as well. But I think just all those strong connections and ties to UVA, I think, has also been something that was really helpful and grounding. So Steve came in as the head coach, as I was, you know, leaving. April took leave after I graduated as well, tapped into Steve, and he allowed me to kind of train at UVA while I was still working at Ferguson to get ready for the draft. And then, yeah, got drafted to play for Boston Breakers.
And then how long after that were you with the national team? That was pretty quick after that.
Yeah, I started getting called in again, youth national, U20s. I was kind of in the pool in college. Probably after my first year of college was with youth teams or youth team. And then 2000 got called up with the national team a little bit more regularly. I think it was 1997. There was a U.S. soccer festival in which a lot of the veteran players were taking a little bit of time. So they brought up a bunch of the youth players and played with my first full national team moment in 97, but it was really 2000 when I started getting called back in. And then 2001, when really I give credit to being able to be in that environment, that professional environment, you know, with other national team players, both domestically and abroad, and having a pool that, you know, could be scouted from and starting to play with the national team pretty regularly at that point.
When you have like big formal events, do you ever just, you know what, I'm going to throw on one of my gold medals today and it'll go nice.
Actually, I brought these here to show you all now.
Oh, yeah. Wow. That would have been really cool. That would have been a great move.
Great segue. It's interesting. So I don't know if you can see, Allie Krieger's right here. So I grew up with Allie and her family. Her brother and I played club, high school, and college together. And you know, Ken just passed, her father just passed, but he was my coach too. And Allie, so when Allie was with the national team, I was coaching 10, 11, 12 year old girls at the time. And when I told them that, like, I know her, the little girls just, oh my God, like, I, within a couple weeks, I probably had like 10 little Allie Krieger jerseys running around at practice. That was their new favorite player. And it didn't matter who was, you know, we had a Wombach, didn't matter. Allie was their favorite player. And it's interesting though. I say that because you turn on sports right now, you turn on the news, women's sports are dominating the news more than ever before. You turn it on, it's Angel Reese, it's Caitlin Clark, it's the WNBA, and they're crushing it. You guys just signed this huge contract, and it's so cool to see. I've got a daughter. I would love for her to experience some of this stuff and have little heroes to jump onto and buy their jerseys and all that fun stuff. And I mean, what are you noticing? Are you noticing is it growing? Is it a different shift? I mean, what's it looking like to you? Are you seeing the same thing that the WNBA and women's basketball is seeing on the soccer side?
I think it's a little bit of everything. And it's just been building in a long time coming, really. And I think people are now seeing the value, seeing the professionalism, seeing the excitement, seeing how good these athletes really are. And I think there's just more attention that has now been focused and spotlighted on these athletes. I mean, I remember just from a marketing perspective, and it was just like slightly before my time, but I mean, the national team players were going door to door telling people that they had a game coming up, you know, and, you know, the investment is shifted, has changed, right? So when that happens, more marketing, more exposure, the media rights, right, are now more appropriate to where it needs to be. And I think there's an understanding of just that influence that you're just talking about with all those little girls, right? That has always been there, but I think it just has not been one tapped into or really valued in the way that it has, or it's now being valued. So yeah, it's crazy to think that, you know, Angel City is 4 years into the making. This is our third season, but obviously some of the build up in that first year, and we are now the most highly valued soccer team for women in the world. And that's just with such a short period of time, with this, you know, new investment that you both are alluding to. So I think that's just to say what type of expansion and at what rate. I mean, that says it all right there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I started watching WNBA. I don't watch much sports. I've got little kids. I watch a lot of Bluey right now. So,
but Bluey, I watch Blippi.
My father-in-law had on, what's it? Caitlin Clark, was he on The Fever? So I was like, all right, let's watch some. She's incredible. And, you know, I'm watching the other girl, Angel Reese. And I'm like, she's a monster in the, like, how do you stop her? You know, and both of them are just fantastic players. And I can, they're young. They're going to give us hopefully 20 years of this. And there's going to be more just popping in. And I think soccer is absolutely there. Do we have anybody coming up that are going to be, you know, it's a little rivalry between those two as well. Do we have maybe a soccer version of that, that you have one on your team and then the New York one, and we can go watch that game? And
yeah, I mean, we got to get you guys to these games just to witness it in person. Because, and I say that not just in jest, but we can seat 22,000 people in our stadium. And, you know, we've sold out fairly consistently, you know, each season. I think we average probably about 18,000 per game.
That's right.
And, you know, I've had a little full circle moment when my parents came out to visit a few months back. And, you know, thinking back to the Beach FC days and, you know, when I first started out and pigtails and orange slices and Capri Suns, right? Like all the good stuff. And here I'm bringing my parents to my work and showing them this incredible club and team in front of 22,000 fans, which I just would not have been able to envision that, you know, growing up and as a young person and player in the sport, and to see that today, I think it is really incredible. And I think, you know, for some of those rivalries and stars, I mean, we also as a club are the team that has the most youth players in terms of U18 players out of any other club in the NWSL. So we have a 16-year-old, we have a 17-year-old, an 18-year-old, and a 19-year-old. And the 18 and 19-year-old are sisters from, you know, Southern California, Alyssa and Giselle Thompson. Kennedy Fuller is our 17-year-old. She just scored in our game this past weekend. And Casey Fair, our 16-year-old, played in the World Cup this past summer for South Korea. So, you know, we also are a club that believes in development. And I think as we see some upcoming, we're going to see some rule changes in terms of the league and all that implicates development and youth development, you know, more academies. Needed. There's the USL is starting a new league coming up this summer as well. And the pool is larger, right? There are more opportunities, but it's a need because we have more players that are more quality. And I think that is also part of this evolution that we're seeing, you know, in the development of Caitlin Clark's and Angel Reese's and, you know, the Kennedy Fullers, the Giselle and Melissa Thompson's, a Casey Fair. So, you know, I think it's an exciting time to actually see quality professional athletes who are fun and also exciting to watch.
Yeah, Scott, can you imagine being 16 and playing? Remember when you were 16 and when I was 16? There's no professional soccer for it. It had nothing to do with our level either.
I was an idiot. There's no way.
Yeah. Well, trying to figure out what to wear to school that day. Like, you know, like what's going on?
Well, it's like
that these players, these young players possess, and I know that it's talent and it's, you know, the ability to play, but there's something in between their ears that makes them different. And so, you know, you have very young players and you have some very old salty veterans on your roster. And, you know, what do they have in common that makes them professional and has brought them to that level to compete, not just in your league, but also at the national team level?
I think going back to an earlier point of just how people handle pressure is a huge part of it, right? Because this is different playing professional than it is, you know, playing in high school and then having the abilities to play pro. I think that's a huge part of it. And especially with our club, right? We are probably unlike any other club, at least in this league and perhaps globally as well, with that pressure and privilege, with the expectations, with the eyeballs domestically and globally and what we're trying to achieve. And I think that is a huge part of it. I think how we have built our culture and continue to build our culture as well, how they fit into that is extremely important, right? And how they are able to relate to a 19-year-old or a 32-year-old, right? I think also the culture that we've created, and very proud of our players for continuing to sustain and grow the culture of being welcoming enough to our younger players where they do feel comfortable and hopefully challenged too, but supported. And I think that was something that came up with at least one of our players who had, you know, been to a handful of other clubs in the league. And this was the one that she wanted to play for because she did feel that. She did feel that from the rest of the teammates. And so I think that's largely, attributed to, the culture that the players have built and what they do on a day-to-day basis and how they view as well players that are younger coming in. Because ultimately, those older veteran players are really helping to mentor and show how to be a pro. So I think all those things go into consideration in one, bringing in those younger players, but also how they handle all of that is really what helps them to stand out.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you as the general manager, you have to make sure that that interaction is going to take place. So like, how are you assessing the older players, and then, how do you know that they're not just going to turn their backs on the younger players as they come in and say, figure it out, rookie, or, as opposed to, I want to put my arm around, there's that arm around you, and, kind of there's two sides to that story, I'm sure, where they're nurturing, but they're also kind of giving them tough love at the same time. I mean, how did you know that that was going to work? Or did you, it's always a roll of the dice, I'm sure, but, I'm sure you had some conversations prior to putting those pieces in place.
I think some of it is highly intentional. I think with just how we select an Angel City player, and also knowing the players that we do have, what type of culture that they are building, being able to have different types of ways of assessing throughout a season of what actually does go on, in the locker room space, let's call it, right? In that locker room culture. We also have a player leadership group that's responsible for helping to manage and being leaders in the locker room as well. So I think some of those are very intentional with how we set up infrastructure within a club and how we continue to build culture. We have a consultant come in and really work with our player leadership group with them that she leads them in. So all of that is very intentional. And the hope is with all of these things that are intentional, it will either help fill in the gaps with things that are unknown or things that we just have to try out. But ultimately, I go back to how we build our staff culture and the type of support we provide our players and the standards and expectations that our head coach sets forth with our players and the team. And when those things don't happen, there needs to be accountability as well. And so I think all of these things, where it might not be specific to a veteran player and a younger player, it goes into how we interact with each other and what type of standards we hold as a group. And all of those things will definitely impact, how that treatment happens.
And when you talk about building your roster, you've got a few different ways you've already alluded to the transfer. Obviously we got college kids, but you got some high school kids in there. You have some international kids. What's it look like for you? I mean, I'm sure this is a huge question, but you mentioned transfer, you got the draft. Do you have a homegrown system as well? I mean, how do you build your roster and kind of, it's mostly this, but we this is trending up, we're getting more college kids. I mean, what does your roster build look like, and how do you put your focus?
It is definitely multifaceted in terms of the where and the how and the different elements that we are evaluating from one window to the next. It starts with our existing roster and what do we have, how are players performing, and then where are the gaps, what do we need. I think it's also about the now and it's about the future. Obviously I just mentioned four players 19 and younger on our team, so there's an element of really being strategic about the future and growth and developmental capacities, and then also who are the players that are need to be brought in to impact the now. And this, the transfer windows, the roster build is probably very much a chess game. I think there are a lot of moving pieces, especially when we've been very fortunate to have a lot of inbound just by virtue of, you know, our club and our location and, you know, our values of, you know, what we're trying to do and achieve in the project that we have. So it's also now getting to a point of having a better process where we're not relying on inbound, but we can be proactive and go after targets that we feel will fit our system, we feel will fit our culture, will be an Angel City defined player, that we have our own, you know, criteria of what that looks like. So, you know, then that goes into, is it someone who's abroad? Is it someone who's domestic? Is it someone who is going to be, you know, that college player up and coming, or high school player that, you know, still can make that jump? You know, maybe it's someone who actually, we just need someone who is going to provide more leadership and more experience. So, you know, all of those things really come into play and factor into how we do the roster build. And then it's, you know, taking a look at our salary cap and, you know, the limitations that we have there and what we can do within our cap. And the players that might have an opportunity to get more playing time at another club because we're bringing in, you know, a different player. So there are all these moving pieces, and then you have agents reaching out, and then you have other clubs reaching out, and, you know, how we put those things together. So I think really being in a place now where we have a process of evaluating players that are, you know, really going after our defined player profiles and criteria of, you know, what makes up, you know, at least from a technical lens, you know, what we're looking for in the nine, what we're looking for in the seven, what we're looking for in a goalkeeper, and being able to put that out there and then match players to it and then go after those targets.
So it's a 365 day a year job is what you're saying. It never ends. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Pretty much.
Well, I mean, you're talking about the world's game. So if someone calls you and says, hey, I'm in Argentina, you need to see this girl, you're like, all right, well, I just completed my roster for the day at least, but let me see this video. And she's incredible. And you're like, all right, well, what am I going to do now? So it has to never end. I mean,
And the other caveat is our calendar, our, you know, yearly seasonal calendar, our league calendar does not match up with, you know, the European calendar. Right. So our season, our preseason is like in the middle of the other season in a different country. And so how we try to align and attract players, maybe pick them out of their season, or they're coming into our mid-season. So our next transfer window is August 1, which is a little bit later this year than it was last year. But, you know, all of those things too, just trying to little nuances to play around with.
What's it like when you bring in, you mentioned the 16-year-old. I mean, my brother didn't even get his license until he's like 16 and a half. Does she even have a driver's license yet? I mean,
She's working on it. Okay. she just talked to our player care rep about helping her with the driving test portion.
It's just funny. Do you have some players that have children of their own, and then you've got this girl that doesn't have a driver's license, and they're sitting right next to each other in the locker room. I mean, what a great dynamic that must be. I mean, she must be like, oh, look at all these motherly figures I have in here to talk to.
For U18 players, there are different rules, regulations, and requirements around U18 players. So they actually have to have a separate locker room area. So it's just like a whole nother dynamic too, right? Where they aren't in the locker room with the full team. They are in their own space for, you know, safety reasons and things like that. So, but that's, you know, another thing in consideration, right? Can that player, does she have an ability to really blend in with the team? You know, given some of the separations that do exist, but
wow.
We have two mothers on our team that have kids. So
we've had some famous ones, of course, like have a baby and then they're playing in the next World Cup, of course,
which is incredible.
Some awesome stories.
Oh my gosh, it's amazing.
Something I was going to ask was going back to, like, characteristics, attributes, what have been, you know, some of the things that you've seen, like getting, maybe just drilling down a little deeper into like a mentality and how they're handling the pressure and that sort of thing. you know, when you see them in a training or at a, in a match, you know, how are they behaving? How are they handling it? How are they growing into that, even, you know, with your younger players? Because I'm sure that they're not game ready the minute they walk through the door. I'm guessing maybe they are, but, you know, how are they growing into being able to contribute to your guys' mission?
I think almost all of them have actually, and yeah, all of them had an opportunity to start. There was an injury that happened, which precluded one of our younger players from starting. But other than that, we have had these younger players step into some starting positions, and some have maintained that over a period of time. So I think that actually is another measure, is can this player actually come in and make an impact now, even though we understand there's development that needs to be had. So I do think that, and it's not just for the younger players, it's for any player really, with those types of pressures of being able to compete and deal with the wins and the losses, right? What type of successes and what type of challenges you have. It's a very, you know, psychological game. You know, sports are just that. And so I think just looking for the signs, right? Looking at reactions and responses, whether it's in game and or responses and reactions in the training right after a game, right? You know, are these players proactive in seeking out additional work, additional film, additional reps on the field post-training, like all of these things on really helping to train younger athletes and younger pros on how to be a pro. You know, and that's, I think, the biggest challenge for our younger players, is that we currently don't have the best development model, you know, in our league. You know, we are probably very close to starting to look at building out an academy, a second team for our first team, but we're not there yet. So what are the opportunities if they're not getting consistent regular playing time in matches? You know, what does that development opportunity look like? And so I think that's a gap that we have in our league right now. I think there are probably a couple of clubs that do have existing academy structures set up. But I think that's something that, you know, we're looking at, where can we support both in the short term and then, you know, longer term, it is looking at building out an academy in the second team. Because I think that is going to be upon us a lot sooner in terms of that need. And, you know, looking at how, you know, we're showing up to in our backyard, which we're fortunate enough to have, looking at, it was the U17 US versus Japan. And we're looking around and, you know, there are all these college scouts there, college coaches looking at, you know, these U17 national team players. Mm-hmm. And then right next to them, you have these professional scouts, right, and coaches there. So, you know, this is a real area of need. And I think we are at this time and space where it's wonderful. We've seen it in the men's team and men's side, rather, where, yeah, you get a player in at 12, 13, 14, they develop through, and whether they stay with that club or they're sold technically to another one, you know, there is that development pathway. It used to be college for us on the women's side. And, you know, as we spoke about earlier, just all the shifts and changes of what that looks like, we're now in a new era of where that pathway is really going to exist and develop our next, you know, youth player into the pro ranks.
Hmm. Very cool. Cheese, you got something?
No, I'm good.
One last thing. We're all close enough in age where, although you come from a clinical psychologist's household, but, you know, the mental health part of it, which is a pretty hot topic right now. We were told just to kind of suck it up, probably most of our generational type people. Just talk about, you know, how that's changed and what you're seeing, and how women's professional soccer is addressing it. I know it's a big deal in college soccer. So just talk about, you know, how that's being addressed by you guys as a league. Just dive into that a little bit.
I think the awareness portion of it is what's really key, because probably back, you know, in our days growing up, I mean, I'll speak for myself, I probably wasn't aware of any type of mental health, you know, event or circumstance I was going through until maybe after the fact, or didn't even recognize it as that. I think I can at least easily pinpoint back to when I retired from soccer. You know, I look back now, I was like, oh, I was depressed, like during this time, like, I didn't realize it going through it, but now looking back, I'm like, oh, right, that's what that was. And I think just having language, having awareness, having it, you know, very visible and talked about out in the open really helps us, one, to understand individually what we're going through, perhaps, you know, much earlier on. And what that does is then you can actually get help for that, right? So if you're not even aware of what you're going through, sometimes you're not going to even ask for help. And I think that's another thing too, is just being able to ask for help. But ultimately, you know, we as a club take responsibility in just providing resources and helping athletes, you know, connect the dots if they want help, if they need help. You know, we have therapists that have been working with our club since, you know, the first season. We also have sports psychologists, but I think, you know, we have both that players can go to and seek. The league itself has more formal policies in which players can ask for mental health time, which I think is really important. So just providing the ease of asking access to resources, I think, are some of the other things that we're just seeing more of. And, you know, clearly a lot more to go through. But I do think just having that opportunity, that space being created where it is safe to talk about, it's safe to ask for help. I think sometimes athletes are trained not to ask for help, right? Just trained to grind it and push and push and push. But, you know, making sure people know it's okay, one, to ask for help, and it's okay that you're going through it. This is a very unique job and profession, and there are a lot of different challenges that other industries just won't experience. So just knowing that it's okay, and that you're not alone, that there are resources that can help. And oftentimes you're not the only person really experiencing some of these things too.
Well said. Yeah. Geez, got anything else?
I was going to ask you if you knew Carl Greaves over at the beach. Was he coaching yet?
I don't think so. The name does sound familiar. Maybe I just know him just from name of his current position. Yeah.
He just stepped down as the director over there at Beach FC. So I didn't know if your timelines had crossed all, but if we had that common thread, I was going to send him a note about you, but I'm sure he knows well about it.
Amazing.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate you. So yeah, this was awesome. And if Phil does remember me, tell him I said hi.
I will. Yeah. Will he remember you as Cheese or Justin?
Well, he'll remember me as the guy that was maybe pulling on his shirt from behind. I lost
nuisance, that guy. Yeah.
The guy that fouled me 12 times in the game. Yeah. Yeah.
You left your mark. You left your mark, Cheese.
Absolutely. I still remember him. Yeah.
Love it. Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you so much. Really, really appreciate it.
Good luck to you guys.
Thank you. You all as well.
Yeah. No, thank you very much.